Welcome to Insurgent Imagination, brought to you by Current Movements. Insurgent Imagination explores creative arts through a revolutionary lens. Each episode, we dive into works of radical storytelling to explore how art inspires and supports the movement for collective liberation and how the movement informs artists.
We'll examine work from the past, present, and future, and we'll reflect on their meaning with artists, activists, and revolutionary organizers from around the world.
We hope to provide a welcoming space for folks thinking about the intersection of art and revolution.
Insurgent Imagination is written and produced on the unceded ancestral homelands of the Piscataway, Tonkawa, Paiea, and Ohlone peoples. We recognize that this simple land acknowledgement doesn't correct centuries of violence, genocide, and cultural erasure, and we are committed to the restoration of land and sovereignty to Native and Indigenous peoples. For more information about how to support the Land Back movement, visit landback.org.
I'm Katie Pettit, a DC-based organizer and the founder and director of Current Movements.
And I'm Mayuran Tiruchelvam, screenwriter, producer, and assistant professor of social justice fiction filmmaking at San Francisco State University's School of Cinema.
This week, we're going to be returning to part of an interview that we recorded last year with Katie Lonk of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. In our conversation with Katie, we began talking about art and creativity in the direct action space, and we didn't have enough room in the show to share it with you, so we wanted to include that again. To provide some context, it's January 2021, and we are recording this the day after the presidential inauguration. So it's really great to have Katie back with us, and let's welcome them onto the show.
Hey, thank you so much. It's such a treat to be back with the both of you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thank you, Katie. Okay, so I don't know how to start this part. Should I tee it up?
You could, but we could also just say, Katie, how are you doing? What are you feeling in this present moment about anything that you want to feel with us?
Sure, thank you. Right now I'm feeling tired in a good way. I'm letting my body feel that a little bit of exhaustion that can also come with relief. I think a lot of our nervous systems may be finally feeling what it's like to drop the weight, some of the weight of the last 4 years of just constantly being on guard against attack. Built a fire in my backyard fire pit last night and watched the moon kind of rise and set, and 9 hours went by before I even realized it. I was just being with this fire for 9 hours. So that's where I am, kind of trying to slow down into that deep time, as well as cracking up at all of the Bernie Sanders mittens memes.
It's so good. So good. I don't know why I love it so much, but I do.
Now, Katie Pettit, you were there at the inauguration this year. And so maybe you could give us some of the lowdown. What was going on there? What were your fashion choices? What kind of mittens did you wear?
No, it's not happening. I'm not going to talk about it.
Well, okay. Can I just say, so you were there and you've been there and you've been organizing in DC. And I just want to say thank you for playing that particular role in that really critical space and facing some serious danger and threats. So on behalf of so many of us, thank you for being out there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thanks.
One thing I really appreciate about this podcast and the focus on creativity is that creativity asks us to be connected to the present moment, even as we also hold the past and the future. And so just taking a moment to feel into what is it like right now, suspended between past and future. We were talking a little bit before we hopped on here about some of the physical relief and some of the exhaustion that can happen in the body. And being in such a state of struggle for so long, like you're describing, I hope and I believe that conscious practice does not have to disconnect us from the deepest source of our creativity, of our belief in the better futures that we know are possible, like you just said. In a way, it's a refusal to allow even the shortcomings of the neoliberal order that is now going to try to reinstitute itself to limit our sense of what's possible. I guess actually what wants to come up is a question back to the both of you. When we ask the question, what comes next after all this time of tension and fighting and resistance and struggle, how do we ensure that what comes next is not solely dictated by our conceptual, rational, strategic, and sometimes hypervigilant minds, but also by our creativity?
I don't know, Katie, how do we ensure that?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge, for me, even in posing that question, I feel some tension in my body because there's fear. There's fear that if we relax even a little bit, we make ourselves more vulnerable, right? For me, I reach for the sense of control of the rational mind of, oh, if we can create the right strategy to defeat neoliberal consolidation and armed white insurrection, then we'll be safer, you know, and we can't afford to relax around those threats. And oof, yeah, that sense of fear is real. And I just want to acknowledge it.
Yeah. And you set up such a beautiful example of like spending 9 hours under the moon last night and letting your body be exhausted from the relief and from doing something that felt important and probably sacred last night, you know?
It would be really swell if everybody could take that moment. And obviously we all have very different material conditions that we're living under. And maybe this is rational brain, so forgive me. You can throw stuff at me. I feel like part of what we are trying to manifest, I'm going to say trying to manifest rather than fighting for, is a world where everybody has the opportunity to take a moment like that, to sit in warmth and look up at the sky. That's not necessarily a material goal. You don't have to take state power to be able to do that.
Right. It's both material and spiritual because you do need some free time. And ideally, you wouldn't have a body that has been completely harmed by capitalist overwork and violence. It reminds me of Fannie Lou Hamer, who we mentioned in our conversation that's upcoming. There's an album of her singing songs that her mother taught her. And it's so, her voice is so rich. It's so beautiful. And it just reminds me of the ways that, in which our legacies of resistance and of revolutionary transformation have always drawn on creativity, spirituality, a lot through song. I was listening also to a speech by Martin Luther King that Bronte Velez recommended called But If Not, and preaching is singing in the way that he does it. And so just to take the time to listen to that kind of art and that kind of offering, creative and spiritual offering, to me is what helps me kind of slow back down into the present moment while rooting even deeper into these legacies and histories of revolutionary love and transformation, not escaping the current contradictions that we're facing, the current challenges that we're facing, but actually resourcing ourselves even more deeply.
No, I think that's really wise. And that's a part of the work. It's part of the example we set.
I want to thank you because I noticed that I feel really safe with both of you in these conversations because you are people who can hold difficulty with kindness and strength, determination. I learn from you. It's really fun. And sometimes I feel challenged, which is also fun. So, you know, in a world that's very heartbreaking a lot of the time, like, thank you for creating a space for love and a sense of safety and comradeship.
We feel the same way about you. And that's why we're like, Katie, come back. Something happened. Oh, we should just call Katie, bring her back on the show.
Welcome to The Threshold, where we'll take you on a brief journey away from life outside
and speak with a revolutionary healer about practices that can help ground us. They'll also share an exercise or practice with us that you can listen to at the close of this episode. So no matter where and when you might be listening to this, resistance is a constant state of being, and we want everyone to take care of themselves and their communities. As Audre Lorde wrote, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. I like that quote. Our guest, Rochelle Faithful, is a multidisciplinary folk healing artist and healing justice practitioner rooted in the African diasporic tradition of Conjure. They were born in Washington, D.C. and raised in Virginia with a strong affinity to their southern family line in Georgia, Alabama, and Texas. Rochelle supports national and local activists of all backgrounds, particularly leaders of Black liberation movements. They are known for creating spaces to help activists identify and process trauma and invest into healing justice frameworks. Thank you so much, Rochelle, for being with us today.
Sure. I really appreciate you all sharing this platform with me to share about this work. And I think my work is joined by many other people and increasingly more people who are appreciating the power of spirituality in the most expansive way, ways that we can manifest that spirituality and visualize and make real that sense of spirituality individually and collectively. And those of us who also are not seeing that separate from our movement work and actually seeing it as an integral part of how we need to move together is having a spiritual center and a spiritual practice to continue to endure all the things that come with choosing to be in movement and wanting to be in movement long term. So I consider myself a multidisciplinary healing artist. I also identify as a healing justice strategist, a cultural worker, a complex conversation facilitator, and I also have a background, as you know, as a community lawyer and as a community organizer. So I consider all of those pieces of my experience part of the work I do. And for me, as a person who didn't grow up in a particularly like religious household or spiritual household, I understood and came to spirituality as a way of wanting to feel a deeper sense of connection in my own life and a deeper sense of meaning in my own world. And finding that initially in social justice movements and deepening that over time with a sense of spiritual connection, and for me, particularly ancestral connection, and connection to land and connection to all other beings. For me, ritual is a way that allows us to really just show our intention, a way to understand why we are doing the things that we do. So ritual doesn't have to be overly complicated. It doesn't have to look a certain way. And it doesn't also need to have a very religious meaning. I think ritual can just be a way of understanding of how we are trying to really cement intention at a particular time in a particular way.
You know, I read the piece that you had published this summer, and you talk about the tradition called Conjure. And can you tell us about Conjure and how it came into your life?
Absolutely. I always love to rap about Conjure. So Conjure is a tradition also known as Hoodoo that is the African diasporan tradition of the U.S. South. And it's in the same family of diasporic traditions as Santeria, as Voodoo, and some other traditions that are becoming better known, though maybe not better understood. And Conjure is like that. So for me, I grew up with a father who is from a Black family from the Midwest. They claim a few different traditions, including Christian Science, which I didn't grow up with, but grew up with some remnants of it through my father. And my mother, who is from deeper in the South, a military family, both my friends are military, but there was an army family. And she had a more kind of deist spirituality that was informed in part from traveling the world when she was younger with my grandfather's service. So we didn't grow up steeped in any particular religion or tradition. And even though I grew up in a very fiercely evangelical white suburban community outside of DC, I was long seeking for a sense of greater connection and a sense of spirituality. I felt it innately, but I didn't quite find something that fit for me. I was very sure that the particular brand of evangelical Christianity that was surrounding me and immersing me was not it. But I wasn't sure what my affirmative was. So I was on a seeking path, and I'm always on a seeking path, but particularly through my college years, which for me was like 18 through 22. Afterward, I was able to actually be really rooted in a Sangha community here in DC that studied the Dharma and some Buddhist teachings. That was a really pivotal moment for me. All the seeking culminated in me leaving full-time law in 2014, saying that I needed to really just invest in my creative and spiritual paths and being open to what would unfold. And I was brought onto a shamanic training, which is something, shamanism was something I was vaguely familiar with, but not deeply familiar with for a couple of years leading up to that point. But I continued to follow the yes that was in my own gut and my own being. And it brought me to this course that I can tell more stories about, but essentially it had me ask for the first time if I had a connection to my blood ancestors, and not necessarily the ancestors that come directly from my lineage, but through a sense of collective ancestors, particularly ancestors who transitioned on Turtle Island, what would that mean? And it allowed me to seek out a nature reverent and ancestor reverent tradition, which if you're from the African diaspora in the US, leads you to folk healing. And I was brought back to conjure. And I say brought back again, because not because I grew up with this tradition, not even enough to be afraid of it, which many Black Americans are, but brought me back to a more indigenous tradition that was connected to land and other beings and ancestors and village wisdom and ritual. And to this day, I continue to try to elevate conjure as a folk healing tradition and a shamanic tradition. For some reason, if you try to search for conjure or hoodoo under shamanism, you just won't find it. And to me, that's a very racialized reality. But it has all the components of a shamanic tradition. If you are practicing that intersection of magic and spirituality and natural medicine, it's very important to me in the memory of the ancestors who were enslaved and still practice their liberation the ways they did it. They practice this form of spirituality in a lot of sometimes even visible ways that just weren't recognized. And even in kind of the antebellum era, there were white folks, former enslavers, that still like sought this medicine and sought this tradition because it just, it's a powerful tradition. And I just invite people to think about, if you really know the brutality and the terrorism of enslavement and understand the terrorism that continues today, this is the tradition that persists through it and has held a sense of expansion many centuries and decades. So that to me is what conjure is as a overall description. And it consists of many things, everything from herbal medicine, which we call root work, to more kind of esoteric healing, like how you deal with ghosts called haints or hags, depending on your tradition, and to a lot of things which folks would recognize as being a part of many shamanic traditions or folk traditions, like sacred drumming and music making, to dance, the ring shout, which is still really popular in certain Christian circles, was rooted and is rooted in conjure. So there's a lot that's embodied here, including a lot of ritual, altar making, candle work, mojos, which are our amulets. So there's a lot in that tradition. And it's one that I practice some traditional parts of, but also try to innovate for this moment for who we are.
Can I have two follow-up questions to that? One is your community of other practitioners. Like, how did you find and build that community? And then the other part is if somebody wanted to reconnect with these traditions that were in their lineage, where would they begin?
These are great questions I spend a lot of my time working on. I think it's a constant evolution of folks I consider peers in this practice, because sometimes I find a lot of peership not only in other people who practice hoodoo or conjure, but also other spirit workers who have a sense of, again, ancestral connection, integrity and authenticity in whatever connection that is, as well as people who do understand that having a systemic analysis is actually part of your practice, right? Because I always challenge particularly like white new age practitioners who are like light and love all the time, Like, first, you've got to actually confront the viciousness of this world to actually be an effective healer, first and foremost. And second, I don't know how you can have any depth to your work if you don't understand the levels of trauma that people are experiencing individually, but collectively. Like, if you can't tap into the collective psyche of any, like, in general, but also in particular groups that are subject to oppression, I just don't think you're doing meaningful work. It's always I think, very much like organizing. I think many healers are organizing right now to find each other. And I'm part of those streams of people. So sometimes I find those peers in healing justice community. Sometimes I find those peers in other folks who are like reclaiming ancestral traditions. And that can happen in like herbal communities. It can also just happen in other kind of esoteric spiritual communities. So I always take every opportunity to find like each other to try mm-hmm. to connect with folks and understand their practice and to experience what they practice too, so that I can continue to be my own nexus to connect other healers with the beings that need them. I'll also acknowledge that one of my roles in the world right now is as a magic doula. So I'm spending a lot of time supporting people in their own awakening, which is beautiful, right? Because I had that doulaship, and I think we have to be doing that for each other right now. And it doesn't always look like, and most often doesn't look like, individuals dedicating their lives to being a space holder or being a quote healer. I think for many of us, we are awakening to our healing capacities, and we need to support each other in whichever those capacities are, right? Including if that's like making powerful media that's going to wake us all up. So whatever that is, I spend a lot of time doing that. It is a challenge to find reliable resources around Conjure and Hoodoo. So one thing I'll recommend is that there are a number of different podcasts and other folks that are fairly easy to find on the social medias who are elevating this work. So I recommend even just doing a kind of general search, but more on the podcast side to find some of those folks. That's one recommendation. The second is there are a few books from scholars who are also practitioners that are really good. So one of them is actually behind me. It's Black Magic, Religion and the African-American Conjuring Tradition by Professor Yvonne Chiru at Swarthmore, which I highly recommend, and a few other works. But she also has a really great blog called Academic Hoodoo, which I recommend folks take a look at because it's a good intro to the tradition from a person, again, who has a lot of respect for the tradition. The one other set of books I would also recommend is a New York-based healer who I like a lot named Chiron. His practice is called Impact Shamanism, Chiron Armand. But he has a really great set of books. One is called Deliverance, which is a spell book that I have found really useful and powerful. And another book of his is Clearing Spaces, which is a great book on how to do ritualistic clearing of spaces, which is helpful ranging from land to home spaces. I think I'll make one more recommendation, which is Working Conjure by Sun Moise. That was recommended to me. I really like that. It's an introduction to Conjure, and he does a lot of work around the dead. So graveyards, crossroads spells, really traditional conjure work. But if you are dealing with grief and transitions, if you're dealing with wanting to connect more deeply to ancestors, actually working with the dead in that way is really useful.
Rochelle, Myron mentioned this article at the top of the show, but you wrote an article called On Grief, Land, and Ritual this last July, a really lovely piece. And something you just said in your last answer made me think of the part where you talk about conjure and why you wanted to dig more deeply into it. And I'm wondering if you could read an excerpt from your article.
I'd be happy to read this. I want to learn about grief work from people who were seized by the grips of grief in their daily lives. Forced migration, separation from family at auction blocks, loss of freedom, constant threat to the most ruthless physical punishment, subjected to unrelenting sexual violence, poor living conditions and medical care, if any, and deprived from the profits of their labor. These are the people who are deeply familiar with grief. In many instances, they found ways to survive it. So this quote to me is about acknowledging that I'm a descendant of these people. And there's never a way to describe enslavement in the U.S. or really anywhere, particularly during the slave trade period, that I think can really be illustrative of just how brutal of an existence it was. But the more and more vivid that reality is, the more profound, magical, moving it is to me that these folks found a way to survive it and to, you know, albeit with profoundly broken hearts, but found ways to survive it. And hoodoo was a part of it. Conjure was a part of it. A connection to each other that is unique from the connections from Africa and unique to the particular place that and circumstances these folks found themselves in, that they were able to create a tradition from it, from that set of experiences, and allow that to sustain themselves is the source of power to me. Real power, not these really hollow power plays that we're even seeing in our country at this moment. It is a deeper sense of power that I think only a sense of spirituality or purpose can really point you to.
Yeah, I think it's so, so powerful. And when I read that, that's exactly how I felt, was just the power that comes from my own survival. You know, the reason that I am here is powerful. The reason that you, Rochelle, and so many other Black folks in this country, like, is power. And to think about how spirituality and different rituals and traditions can live beyond so much gives me a lot of hope and clarity of what's possible today in this moment and in the times that we currently find ourselves.
I can't agree more. I marvel at Blackness more and more every day. And I'm like, Blackness is made of stars and it's made of this. And what could be more powerful?
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
Our inability to collectively gather together as community to grieve what's going on in the world, what's going on in our communities, or what's going on, you know, with our people who are being incarcerated. It's a major, you know, part of this year, right? It's a major disconnection that we're all experiencing this year. So do you have thoughts about how we can collectively grieve even though we can't be together physically?
I do. It's a really important question. I think it requires two things. I think it requires, in part, us being willing to feel like we are collectively connected, even if we're not physically connected. And if we do hold that belief, that means that a few different opportunities can flow from it, right? What if you are doing ritual at a site of water? And those you're connected to have water connections, right? Can you still be connected that way? There are ways that we can be creative. So if we are ritualizing word medicine or letters to one another, right? Is there ways that we can pass these messages on, this medicine on through the mail? So it's sequential, it's collective, but it's not necessarily the way that we think about gathering at one place simultaneously. So I think if we have some expansiveness, we can find ways to collectively be together. And I'm also aware that folks are finding ways to still gather safely. So there's, in that way, sanctity in these beautiful consent-based conversations we're having with one another about how we can be physically together but still feel safe in the work. And I'm finding folks are finding those ways, and nature is a great ally in that. So I trust in our resourcefulness, as I always have. And that's another reason why I value traditions like conjure that don't require much, but some sense of possibility and some sense of resolve.
Thank you, Rochelle, for being here, for sharing everything that you shared, and also the ritual that we'll be able to participate in at the end of the show. So I'm just so thankful for you for sharing your wisdom and guidance with us.
Really, thanks for asking me to be here. I don't take it for granted that folks are really thinking about healing in this moment so that we can actually survive through our movements and be, you know, even better than that. So thank you for sharing the space with me and offering me an opportunity to share.
are now about to jump back into the conversation we had with Katie Lonk last November. Katie is a part of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Oakland, California.
So, Buddhist Peace Fellowship, do you want to describe it real quick?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we're a constellation of spiritual political seekers who just want to support each other through, you know, we're all committed to movements. Like, this is sort of our, this is our path in this life, is that we love movements. We love transformative change, radical change. And yet, often we feel that the spiritual dimension can be missing from our movements, or we have to kind of bifurcate or segregate our lives and like kind of be like secret Buddhists and out in the streets with other people fighting to defund the police. So yeah, we have gatherings. We use a framework called Block, Build, Be, about blocking harm and oppression, building the beautiful alternatives that we want to see, then also learning how to be with the reality, with the truth of suffering and the truths of awakening, just being rather than doing all the time. So it's a great, it's such a beautiful kind of network and calling together of people who just want to live compassionately with these challenges of being a spiritual person in movements right now.
I was saying it's just a beautiful description of a summation of what your organization and what your colleagues and you do.
Thanks.
And that's where you and I met, and I went to a Black Belt B gathering a few years ago, and I was struck when you spoke during that time about your direct action experience and how you meld that with your spirituality. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your direct action experience, as well as focus on that intersection of art and the revolution.
Yes. You know, lately I've been thinking about that famous quote from Dr. Cornel West, where he says, "Justice is what love looks like in public." And so for me, nonviolent direct action is an expression of love. I mean, that's the simplest way to put it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that I maybe misunderstood it earlier in my life. Like, I thought when justice is what love looks like in public, like we have to demand and fight for justice so that love can happen, so that our society can be more loving, right? So that someone like Breonna Taylor can be actually loved in the way that she deserves. Uh-huh. And now I'm beginning to think of it kind of differently. Like, I think that justice is not the precondition that we have to fight for in order to bring love into society. I think justice is the effect of our love and our work in the world. Justice is the outcome, or almost like the byproduct, or the positive symptom. Mm-hmm. And our love, when it becomes so huge and enormous and irrepressible, can express and present itself as a revolution, or as a nonviolent direct action, or as jail support, or as picking someone up, you know, coming out of prison, or all kinds of material ways, right, that we're very familiar with in movements. We feel that love through mutual aid. We feel that love through door knocking, people taking the time to meet their neighbors. You know, we feel it getting out into the streets, being with hundreds of thousands of people, you know, because we're upset about how cruel, how unnecessarily cruel our systems are. Like, that's love. And so we want our love to be able to cultivate more justice, more outcomes of justice in the world. But I think it would be a mistake to await justice as the precondition for love, or to demand justice before we allow ourselves to love. I think that that's actually backwards. And I sometimes say that trust is built and earned, whereas loving kindness is offered and extended. So trust, yeah, you can't trust everyone all the time, you know? Like, politically, yeah, there are people who do harm and who are untrustworthy. But very weirdly, very paradoxically, we have the power to extend loving kindness to all beings, regardless of whether they're trustworthy. And I see this in, like, Fannie Lou Hamer. She was armed, you know,
there were people trying to assassinate her. And she was like, look, you will not assassinate me. I will shoot you first. Like, you know, for folks who may not know, Phelan Hamer, like civil rights activist in the South, incredible, like also food sovereignty, like brilliant. Okay. So, but she was like, you can't make me hate you. White people do not have the power to make me hate them. And that is such spiritual sovereignty, right? Like, she's just like, usually she would just laugh. I picture her laughing most of the time. You got to love them because like hating will make you sick and weak. That's what she said. Hating will make you sick and weak. So you just got to love them while, you know, and while being uncompromising. But it was coming from love and coming from kind of this invincibility. And that's what I aspire to. James Baldwin had that. Toni Morrison has that. You know, so many of the people that I admire politically kind of have this like, yeah, I might not trust you, but you can't stop my love. You don't have that power.
That's so beautiful and important. And I think so hard for us to hold on to.
Especially when you're out there on the streets, face to face with the phalanx of fascist cops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was younger, so much of a direct action was also just like an adrenaline rush, but that doesn't yes. last forever. And yes. in fact, leads to a lot of burnout.
Yes.
Whereas maybe the love can be an endless regenerative source.
Yes. And thank you. Let's talk a couple of just details and specifics and paint some pictures. So we all know we're talking about the same stuff, right? Because like nonviolent direct action can look a lot of different ways, right? And I love how y'all are framing it in terms of art and creativity too, because I think, right, like I moved to the Bay Area around the time of the uprisings for Oscar Grant, who was murdered by the BART police. And so I was just like dove right in, you know, I was out in the streets with people. We were doing these snake marches, trying to avoid the cops, trying to avoid being kettled, just like where they, you know, come and contain you so that everyone could be arrested. Like our undocumented comrades had to like jump residential fences, you know, and just like hand their backpack to someone to hold to be like, I can't get caught up in this. Like, I gotta go, you know? So people were really, again, showing love, taking care of each other. Our county jail, Santa Rita Jail, is I think currently the most deadly jail in the state in California. So like for folks to get caught up in there, it's just, yeah, it's, there's a lot of harm. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of harm going on constantly. And then sometimes directed towards protesters and uprisings, right? Yeah, I resonate, Myron, with kind of this like the adrenaline feeling of trying to confront the oppressors or the guardians of the order of oppression, at least, and the, you know, people who are executing it. There is, okay, I want to tell this one story about a freeway takeover. So this was maybe in like 2015-ish. I think it was the night that, was it Darren Wilson, mm-hmm. who murdered Mike Brown, was acquitted, or, you know, the grand jury refused to prosecute him. So by that time, the freeway blockades in Oakland were pretty frequent. And so everyone knew, okay, we're going to get up on a freeway. So we got up on 880, just south of downtown, south of the police station. Hundreds, if not thousands of people, you know, up on the freeway blocking traffic in both directions. So there's like a sea of taillights, red taillights in, you know, one direction, and a sea of headlights in the other direction. And I will never forget witnessing this exchange. So I walk over to, well, first of all, there's a trucker. He seems to be a Latino man. And he's very supportive. He's like honking his horn. He's letting people climb up on the truck and someone brought like a portable projector and they were like projecting like visuals. People were playing music. Like it was dope. It was, you know, like people were enjoying themselves, having a good time. And he was super into it. And the Port of Oakland, as you know, is like right there. So he's probably a trucker who just picked up a load and is about to drive cross country somewhere. So he's there and hours are going by. Hours and hours. We're all there. No one's going anywhere. We're staying put. But I walk over and I see these two young Black folks who are debating, arguing about what to do about this trucker. He's at the very front of the line of like one of the lines of traffic. So if people temporarily kind of parted the sea and let him through, they could close back up and selectively allow him to go through. Because this man, you know, he's probably losing pay
based on being delayed and detained in this holdup. And he's clearly in favor of this cause, right? He's like not the enemy. And so people were kind of like having this class solidarity moment of like, should we just let this guy go? Like, we can just let him go. And so one of the young folks, this was someone I read as a boy, maybe in high school or something, was just like, no, like this is about how Black lives are more important than any inconvenience, period. We are not letting this person through. People need to understand this. And this young Black woman also, I think probably in high school, was like, basically like, well, yeah, but we have the power right now in this moment. We have the power to decide what to do. And so we can choose how to exercise that power. And that's the point. And I think I walked away before I even understood what the resolution of this was going to be or the decision. But that moment of debate, like, I still get chills thinking about it because I really resonate with both of what they were saying, right? And I loved the heated debate, but also affection and respect that they were showing each other in trying to work this out. And these are the kinds of moments, I think, that are possible within nonviolent direct action where our creativity has to come to bear, because we're actually then being responsive to the moment. We're not just playing out a script. Like, it's a foregone conclusion that, oh, okay, we're just going to hold the line no matter what. We don't care, you know, what kind of compassion or solidarity is shown to us by whom. We don't care if someone experiences a panic attack, like while out in front of the front lines with cops. We don't care if someone with a disability needs to be handcuffed in the front of their body instead of behind. And the cops use that as an excuse to divide all of us and like come down harder on everybody. Like, actually, when we get so rigid in the anger and only the anger, it makes us very narrow. And this really forecloses our responsiveness, our nimbleness, our ability to actually love our comrades in the moment and to keep each other a little bit safer, potentially. Yeah. So I love those moments when we are aware and awake enough in the midst of a direct action to collectively inquire into the actual conditions that we're facing. That's agency, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a really beautiful story. I love that. And I'm especially that, you know, it has stayed with you for all this time.
Mm-hmm.
And a really kind of visual, visceral, like I could imagine the whole scene, yeah. You know, as you laid it out. You know, that conversation is probably happening right now, or it'll be happening tomorrow on another street somewhere else, because there's a whole new group of young folks that are out there.
Yeah.
Kind of figuring out how to navigate the front lines, if we want to call them that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so excited for this younger generation to have some of these emotional and spiritual skills, right, that we were just talking about, so that our reactivity and our traumas don't, when they get kicked up, they don't tank the situation. You know what I mean? Like, and our comrades, we know each other and we're not ashamed about our trauma. We're not ashamed about our triggers. And so we can actually work with them and help each other to hold them, rather than being punitive about it, or rather than just being completely caught off guard because we haven't actually discussed trauma at all or emotions. Yeah.
If you could share a hope that you have for how we resist over the next few months, what is that hope?
Wonderful question. Thank you. Well, I hope that we will come to know our true selves. And I'm not here to tell anybody what that is for you, you know, like it's really a genuine, like, I hope you come to know your true self and the part of you that feels the most invincible. For me, I actually feel the most invincible when I feel the most insignificant. It's like a weird, it's like that feeling when you look up at a starry sky and you're just like, how small am I? How small is our planet? Anyone I've ever known, all the human suffering that has ever existed is so small. And there's literally no up or down in the universe. That's just a convention that we use. So for me, like, contact with enormity, contact with nature, contact with awe and splendor helps to point me beyond my thoughts and beyond my mind towards what I understand at this moment to be more of my true self. But I can also feel that way in human relationships and within resistance. Like it's, I don't have to escape to like beautiful nature in order to feel awe, which I feel very fortunate about. And I think a lot of meditation has really helped me with personally, because you have to meditate through severe discomfort and pain, or at least I have. One of the teachers at Chosenji, the Rinzai Zen temple in Hawaii, one of his favorite expressions is like, yep, gotta die like a rat. just not be afraid to fall apart. And so I think in coming to know our true selves through resistance, I think we will discover an enormous and incredible capacity for compassion, for generosity, for creativity, for solidarity, for de-escalation. Yeah. Like that's kind of one of my favorite miracles right now is like, even within our movements, like comrades who like stuff is starting to like escalate and people are getting tense. And then like some people, sometimes there can be this like wash of a wave through like this beautiful, flowing, spacious deflation that just lets things come back into contact. So I wish many of those moments for us, just many of those like surprising, beautiful, humbling moments of, oh, like this isn't what I thought it would be. And it's really, really, really beautiful. And that can happen whether things are in a good condition or in a really terrible condition. I wish that I could effectively wish that nobody would get hurt or nobody would die. Mm-hmm. But we know that people are getting hurt and will get hurt and will die. So the question is, what do we do? Mm. And how do we learn? What does that point us to? What truths about our own lives and our own selves and our own ability to be present in each moment of life?
Thank you. That is a great hope. I love everything about this conversation. So thank you so much, Katie.
Something that I've seen, and I had a meeting yesterday with a bunch of organizers in DC about, but I feel like there's more avenues to hide from uncomfortable emotions and from the fear and the pain and the grief that is our reality right now. And I think people are seeking out in this country even more than before distractions, be it obsession over sports or reality TV shows or work or, you know, all of these things that our culture allows for us to Netflix, you know, just disappear into an alternate reality, which has its place for sure. So it's not from a place of judgment. And at the same time, as I hear you speak, your spiritual practice has allowed you to like search out all of those hard, uncomfortable feelings and allowed you to be brave and courageous. And I think that's a part of spirituality, right? Is like learning that courageousness, but it's also a part of organizing and activism, not turning away from the hard truths. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of that process for you or the importance of it and how you see that playing out into the months we have ahead?
Well, thank you so much. And I just love being in conversation with you, Katie. And it's said that the Buddha once said that spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life. And I just feel that particular joy to just be with you and to talk about things that are still kind of rare and special to be able to talk about in movement contexts, right? So I really thank you. And it means a lot, you know, coming from you, because I know that it's hard. And that this work helps to bring out the bravery when it's needed. yes, there's many avenues for hiding from or avoiding. And so we, yeah, feel a lot of reassurance from knowing that this ain't new. Like, the Buddha was like, yep, aversion. Like, people don't want to feel what's uncomfortable and unpleasant. That's like a very longstanding truth and reality that we are now currently experiencing together. And like, I loved how you put it. You know, I can hear it in your voice, no judgment. It's all love. It's identification in a way. It's like, yeah, we've all been there. You know, I don't, this is too much. I don't want to, got to check out. And on the flip side, I mean, I think there's a danger of making an identity out of bravery, like, which again could maybe lead to like an overextension into danger or into martyrdom, or like I constantly have to feel like what I'm doing is so important or so amazing or bold or meaningful. And so then you're just like hustle, hustle, more, more, more. And it's a very nuanced process. Like I really can't give a blueprint to anybody. But what I can say is like Sangha or spiritual community to kind of be with and be open to people whose path looks very different from yours. Like I have found that the more I'm open to spiritual teachers who don't speak in movement language, like I just build my confidence that like they're not gonna gaslight me into giving up my commitment to the movement. Like that's just not gonna happen. So instead I can actually be really centered and steady and open to maybe what they have to share and their perspectives. Yeah, just noticing, being able to non-judgmentally witness when we want to distract ourselves. I mean, this is, as you know, like kind of the entire practice. It's just like moment to moment, those, you know, it's like, okay, my mind wants to rehearse all these possibilities for a coup, you know, and what could be coming. And my mind wants to like anxiously spin and work over all these different scenarios. Okay, I'm noticing that. Or I'm noticing that my mind wants to like fantasize about my crush and like Corona erotica and like, you know, just completely, yeah, get lost in thinking about the past or fantasizing about the future or, you know, whatever it is. And so like to me, it's kind of like we're learning how to be these musicians who work every day with our instruments and kind of our symphony. And we're learning how to be able to listen to all the different instruments that are in our symphony or in our group. And so I can hear my instrument, like the voices that, you know, the thoughts that are playing in my head. But I also want to be able to tune into, oh, what are the bird songs that are outside of my window right now? Oh, what's the like texture and the light on my houseplant, on the leaves of my houseplant? You know, what am I feeling? What's the kind of like irritation that I feel when there's dirty dishes in the sink for my housemates or something, you know? And what's the joy that I feel when I run into a neighbor outside and we like have our little conversation with our masks on or whatever? Like, so the ability to just include more and more experience, I think is actually a kind of interestingly can be an effective substitute for distraction, because there's still a lot going on that we can pay attention to in the present moment. And so the more that we're with community that encourages us to fully taste the present moment, like fully really eat the apple, if you're eating the apple or if you're eating the hot link or if you're eating the La Croix, like whatever, like really be with it, like really be with the texture, the flavor, the smell, the substance. And then when you're in the nonviolent direct action and you're facing off against cops, like you'll be able to be in the present, and this will give you superpowers.
Thank you for that. That's so, and that's again why I love the work that you and Buddhist Peace Fellowship are doing to be able to hold that balance, that healthy balance, because as you were talking about like the, how it can be, you know, the other side of the pendulum when we are only in our bravery, I feel like as activists and organizers, we do love that adrenaline rush, or we do love, or we use our work as a distraction to maybe other parts of our lives. But if we can, you know, have this balance of staying present and staying aware of ourselves, our community, the world, we can be so much more loving, which is the goal.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I love how hungry our movements are. You know, I don't fault us for that. Like, we want to do such big, gorgeous things, and we want full spectrum intersectionality, and we want to connect police defunding and demilitarization to environmental justice, to internationalism, to anti-capitalist economies, to like healing our love relationships and our erotic relationships. And, you know, we want all of it. And it makes sense because it's all interconnected. It is all interbeing in the phrase of Thich Nhat Hanh. And so, but yeah, in practice, there's much for us to learn how to be in rhythm together, in a good rhythm that lets us not only survive, but thrive and wake up.
If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting Current Movements on Patreon. We'd like to acknowledge the support of our newest Patreon members, Alana, Sarah, Pago, Delucina, Shannon, Tara, Brianna, Leah, Olga, Mitten, Jackie, Monica, Dante, David, and Rihanna.
Production of this series is sponsored by VizArts in Rockville, Maryland, and San Francisco State University's School of Cinema, College of Liberal and Creative Arts, and the George and Judy Marcus Funds for Excellence in the Arts.
Insurgent Imagination is produced by Imgard Rott and Joshua Gamma and written and produced by Katie Pettit and Mayoran Tiruchelvam from our respective pandemic locales in Baltimore, San Antonio, and San Francisco. Our theme song, There Are Black People in the Future, is by Lavender Freddy. At the end of this episode, Rochelle offers a grounding meditation through their peaceful drumming. Their piece is called The Softest Part.
One of my cores of my practice is using an open-face drum as what I call conjure drum. And it's a way to be connected to drum in a way that you can feel the vibration or the heartbeat of the drum, which to me is just like the heartbeat of us. I've been playing this form of drum that I've made myself with the beloved remains of an elk relation. And whenever I work with conjure drum, it's an invitation to really connect at the deepest levels with one sense of interbeing with land, with plants, with other living beings, but really just at a cosmic level, to even allow the parts of yourself to dissolve in your sense of individual and to really come into the collective consciousness. So this meditation that I've provided for you all is called The Softest Part. And especially in the context of speaking about power, to me, softness is the greatest form of power we can offer to each other now, whether that's a sense of like genuine compassion, the sense of perspective, the sense of longevity, the sense of care, and the magic of concern. So the invitation for you in this meditation is to allow for that softness to come through, to actually be in your own vulnerability to the degree that you can find safety in that vulnerability, but also find liberation in it. Especially for those of us who are the descendants of survivors, which are many of us. And it's a way to honor that survival. in a moment where there is an escalation around this false sense of toughness, which is really just, you know, a precursor to more violence and more harm. So I hope folks enjoy the drum meditation and can touch into their softest part.